Hello, this is Rob Jacobson with the Friday, October 10, 2025 edition of the News Gazette. We'll begin today with the article on the front page entitled "All the Comforts of Home at the Stadium." The mayor of Lot 33, Bob Seidel, and First Lady Viva Seidel arrive at their parking spot at lunchtime on Thursday. For the next 4 days, Lot 33 will be their home away from home, complete with a fully stocked 2021 Fleetwood Bounder 35K, a Class A motorhome. Easy to find, it is blue, black, and white, and located every game near St. Mary's Road and First Street. This weekend, the crowd will be bigger than ever, with number one Ohio State and its loyal fan base traveling en masse to Illinois. Champaign-Urbana transforms into another mobile circus, filling college campuses across the country. It is part of the tradition and the atmosphere that makes college football unique among all sports. The Seidels have an impressive setup, self-contained with a generator, air conditioning, washer, dryer, ice maker, fridge. The RVs also have fans to keep the area cool. Is it the Cadillac of RVs? Absolutely not, Bob Seidel said, but it satisfies our needs. During the University of Illinois football season, the Loda couple forms a community in Lot 33. Most of the necessities are covered, including a fire chief, Lincoln's Ty Johnson, in case the grilling gets a bit out of control. Johnson is in his second year as a season ticket holder and first year in Lot 33. Like the Seidels, he comes to town on Friday, and he brings a bumper pull camper. We set up 2 doors down from them, Johnson said. It's kind of like a tent city. If we need help from a neighbor, it's nice to know who can do what. There's a mechanic, a plumber, an electrician. We're so new to it, but everybody has been very inviting, Johnson said. Johnson, 47, goes to the games with fiancée Maggie Madol and his son, who is attending Illinois College. We are enjoying it. We're loving it, said Johnson, a Decatur native and lifelong Illinois fan. In his office, he's got an autographed helmet and other Illini memorabilia. His seven seats are on the west side in section 223. I plan on never letting those tickets out of our family's hands, Johnson said. Need something to eat pregame? The Seidels are ready. We bring too much food, Bob Seidel said. Viva says it's better to have more than less. Nobody ever runs out of food. The Seidels try to get the same spot every game, which usually happens because they are the first ones there. The parking pass costs $100 per game, up from $25 the first year. The passes are checked and scanned on game day. A lot of people just tape it to the side of their motorhome so they don't get woke up at 7 a.m., Seidel said. There are TVs everywhere. The Seidels have 4 of them, 3 inside and 1 outside. Their neighbors bring a satellite dish so he can watch other games. People look for us, Seidel said. We all just hang around together. Once in a while, Rob Cardinal will stop by. It's a good time. The Seidels bring their 2 Scottish Terriers, Angus and Logan, to every tailgate, wearing Illini gear. They've been doing this their whole lives, he said. At the Illinois-Southern California game, 2 couples from California stopped by and got water. Their son plays for the Trojans. It's a friendly atmosphere, Seidel said. Most weeks, the Seidels come to town on Friday, but with a sold-out, hyped game matching number 17 Illinois and number 1 Ohio State, they decided to travel a day early. Bob, a 72-year-old retired sprinkler fitter, and Viva, a 70-year-old retired PhD, ABD respiratory therapist, and assistant professor at Northwestern University Medical Center, have been married 52 years. They both grew up in Valparaiso, Indiana, and moved to Mahomet in 1975. They have a grandson, Tate, and granddaughter, Piper. The Seidels started their current excellent adventure in 2015. Lifelong college football fans, they bought Illinois season tickets. "We just enjoy football and tailgating," Siddall said. Interestingly, neither went to the school. In fact, Viva's degrees are from Indiana University and St. Francis. Bob's apprenticeship program went through Penn State University. When they first started going to games, they took their pickup and parked clear down in Lot 49. They bought a small motor home and moved up to Lot 42. They have been in Lot 33 for the last 5 years. It is a full weekend for the Siddalls and their guests. "They are there this week from Thursday to Sunday. We enjoy meeting all the other people," he said. Inside the stadium, the Siddalls are in Section 107, Row 54. Their seats are next to Illinois quarterback Luke Altmaier's grandparents. Small world. The Siddalls are on the road for 6 months of the year, taking their Fleetwood Bounder to an RV park in La Belle, Florida, 30 miles east of Fort Myers. They've been doing that for 8 years, arriving in November and staying until April. They don't drive the RV around town. They tow their teal Mini Cooper to Florida. Throughout the year, the Siddalls travel with three other couples for weekly trips. They will miss the Illinois Northwestern game on Thanksgiving weekend because they'll already be in Florida. Continuing on the theme of Illinois football, article on the front page of the sports section entitled "Man with a Plan: What is it like to beat number one Ohio State?" Illini coach Brett Bielema can raise his hand. Brett Bielema doesn't have to imagine what it's like to knock off the number one team in the country. The current Illinois coach has been there, done that. During his time at Wisconsin, Bielema's Badgers upset number one Ohio State 31-18 in 2010. It was the only on-field loss for the Buckeyes all season, though the team later vacated all the wins because of NCAA violations. Does the coach have any special memories of that game? You betcha. It was a player-driven movement, but there was a lot of confidence in what they were doing, Bielema said Thursday at the Smith Center. "I have three of those players in my building now," the Illini coach continued, referencing defensive coordinator Aaron Henry, defensive line coach Terrence Jamison, and assistant running backs coach James White. On Tuesday, Bielema showed his current Illinois team the plan for the week. Andy showed them the 2010 chart for Wisconsin-Ohio State. It looked a lot similar, except Tuesday's practice was 22 periods that I had cut back from 25. This week's practice was 14 I cut back from 16, Bielema said. "If I would have told those guys they were going to have a 24-period practice, I might have had about 12 guys walk out of the room. It's a different era with kids, what I've been trying to preach to them all week. It's not what they know. It's what they feel." Bielema and the 17th-ranked Illini get another shot at number one when Ohio State visits Champaign-Urbana this weekend for an 11 a.m. kickoff on Saturday at Geese Memorial Stadium. Bielema repeated Thursday an earlier request he mentioned in the moments after the Illini won 43-27 at Purdue last Saturday. "Once again, I'll hit the fans up," Bielema said. "I know they've been unbelievable. When this schedule came out about 2 years ago, my whole goal and dream was to put a team together that was able to match the people coming into our stadium. I'd encourage everybody to get up a little earlier, get to the stadium a little earlier, be seated by 10 or 10:30, and make that environment as good as we can. Not only can the fans help with the game at a sold-out venue, but also with recruiting. Illinois has a lot of good recruits coming in," Bielema said. "The feeling when they leave the building is a big part of it." When Bielema coached at Wisconsin, most of the top players in the state wanted to be Badgers. Now in his fifth season at Illinois, he is trying to create the same vibe with the Illini. "You have to build a foundation off guys before you," Bielema said, "and I think that's what we've done." For the second time in 3 weeks, Fox's Big Noon Kickoff pregame show will originate from Champaign, after doing so before the Illini hosted Southern Cal on September 27. "It's kind of the world we're living in right now," Bielema said. "People want to be around people that win. I've told donors, some of the guys that have given us significant money over the last several years, I want them to be proud of what they're doing. Nobody gives money, nobody gives support to something they kind of feel good about. They believe in something, it makes a difference. It has been part of the plan since Illinois Athletic Director Josh Whitman hired him in December 2020. One of the first messages I heard from Josh was to build something sustainable, said Bielema, who sports a 33-23 record with the Illini so far. I don't know what's going to happen Saturday, but I do know we've made a lot of progress, and I'm super excited where we're going. Thursday's workouts are usually a shine and polish day for us, Bielema said. He said running back Aiden Loffrey, who has missed time this season with an injury, has been with us all week. Center Josh Kreutz, who didn't play against Purdue, practiced on Thursday. We'll see where that goes to Saturday, Bielema said. Kreutz was adamant about practicing Thursday. I was really impressed with what I saw, Bielema said. Super resilient and incredibly tough. He's been a 3-year starter. The NCAA approved a new-look transfer portal that will run from January 2 through 16. I knew that one was coming for a while, Bielema said. We've already had proactive discussions with our administration. The University of Illinois has been reluctant to allow January admissions. We have to change that narrative, Bielema said. We'll be left behind in college football if that window doesn't change for us here at Illinois. With number one coming to town, Bielema is hearing more from old friends and long-lost cousins. The best thing that happened last Friday morning, I always take my girls to school, Bielema said. He gets to the Smith Center early, then picks up his daughters. Defensive lineman Zafir Stewart was coming around 7 a.m. for a lift, and I went to bump him, Bielema said. I had my phone in my hand, and my phone fell down and cracked. So my phone didn't work for 3 days. It was a blessing in disguise. More national media requests for Bielema came in this week, but he said he turned them down. I just didn't want to get off my routine, Bielema said. I preach to my guys about living their routine. If I do something on national TV the day of a game, they'll know that I'm not living my routine. And that's a bad message. Shifting gears and moving to state news, an article entitled Operation Midwest Blitz, Judge Blocks Guard Deployment in Illinois. A judge on Thursday blocked the deployment of National Guard troops in the Chicago area for at least 2 weeks, finding no substantial evidence that a danger of rebellion is brewing in Illinois during Trump's immigration crackdown. It's a victory for Democratic officials who lead the state and city and have traded insults with President Donald Trump about his drive to put troops on the ground in major urban areas. The court confirmed what we all know. There is no credible evidence of a rebellion in the state of Illinois, and no place for the National Guard in the streets of American cities like Chicago, Governor J.B. Pritzker said. The judge said the administration violated the 10th Amendment, which grants certain powers to states, and the 14th Amendment, which assures due process and equal protection. It wasn't clear what the troops will do now, including a small number outside a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement building in Broadview. Officials at U.S. Northern Command directed questions to the Department of Defense, which declined to comment, citing a policy that the department doesn't comment on ongoing litigation. The lawsuit was filed Monday by Chicago and Illinois as Guard members from Texas and Illinois were on their way to a U.S. Army Reserve Center in Elwood, southwest of Chicago. All 500 are under the U.S. Northern Command and have been activated for 60 days. Some slept in vans Wednesday night outside the Broadview building near Chicago and emerged Thursday morning on patrol behind portable fences. For weeks, the ICE site has been the site of occasional clashes between protesters and federal agents. Continuing with a related article, an article out of Springfield entitled No More Force, Judge Grants Restraining Order Protecting Protesters, Journalists. A federal judge in Chicago issued a temporary restraining order Thursday blocking federal agencies from using certain forceful tactics to suppress protests or prevent journalists from covering those protests. Judge Sarah Ellis issued that order in response to a First Amendment lawsuit filed Monday on behalf of several news organizations, along with individual protesters and clergy. These plaintiffs alleged that since federal agents were deployed in the Chicago area in September, federal agents have shot, gassed, and detained individuals engaged in cherished and protected activities, especially in suburban Broadview near an immigration processing center. Never in modern times has the federal government undermined bedrock constitutional protections on this scale or usurped states' police power by directing federal agents to carry out an illegal mission against the people for the government's own benefit, the lawsuit argued. Defendants in the suit include Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, Attorney General Pamela Bondi, Acting ICE Director Todd Lyons, and numerous other federal officials. The restraining order temporarily prohibits federal agents from arresting, threatening to arrest, or using physical force against journalists unless there is probable cause to believe the individual has committed a crime. It also prohibits them from issuing crowd dispersal orders without exigent circumstances, requiring people to leave a public place where they otherwise have a lawful right to be. It also prohibits them from using various types of riot control weapons, including tear gas and other kinds of noxious gas, as well as various kinds of less lethal weapons and ammunition. Protests erupted in the Chicago area after the Trump administration launched Operation Midway Blitz on September 8, an immigration enforcement action that the Department of Homeland Security described as an effort to target the criminal illegal aliens who flocked to Chicago and Illinois because they knew Governor Pritzker and his sanctuary policies would protect them and allow them to roam free on American streets. Since that operation began, the complaint argued, roving patrols of masked, militarized, and often unidentifiable agents have been seen on streets from Chicago's city center to its suburbs. Many of the most volatile protests have taken place in Broadview, where Immigration and Customs Enforcement operates a processing facility that houses many of the people who have been arrested or detained during Operation Midway Blitz. The lawsuit states that federal authorities have stationed officers on the roof of that facility armed with weapons that are capable of discharging exploding chemical pellets and rubber bullets, as well as lethal firearms. Other officers are assigned to stand in a courtyard outside the detention facility. In response to the protests, these groups of officers sometimes surge behind the ICE facility fence without warning and storm the protesters, the complaint alleges. They attack by slamming individual protesters to the ground, wielding batons and shields, throwing tear gas canisters indiscriminately at groups of protesters, and macing individual protesters in the face at close range, among other things. The lawsuit also alleges that federal agents have deliberately targeted journalists for harassment and intimidation. It lists several incidents in which reporters have been violently attacked by federal officials, including a September 29 incident when a CBS Chicago reporter was targeted while in her car driving near the Broadview ICE facility checking on the status of protests. A federal agent standing behind the fence shot pepper balls at the journalist's car, and chemicals went through her window, the complaint states. There were no protests or activities at Broadview at the time. The journalist had to stop her car and get out as the chemicals engulfed the interior of her vehicle. The lawsuit was filed Monday, the same day Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul and the City of Chicago filed a separate suit challenging the legality of the Trump administration's decision to deploy National Guard troops in the Chicago area, ostensibly to protect federal facilities and operations from demonstrators. The deployment of troops in the Chicago area followed similar actions earlier this year in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. Trump also recently ordered troops into Portland, Oregon, where a federal judge issued a restraining order preventing him from federalizing the Oregon National Guard. He has also threatened to deploy troops in other cities, including New Orleans and Memphis. The First Amendment lawsuit itself was the source of some controversy within the Illinois journalism community. When it was filed Monday, the original list of plaintiffs included the Illinois Press Association, a nonprofit trade association that represents more than 350 newspapers in Illinois and surrounding states. On Wednesday, however, court records indicate IPA withdrew as a plaintiff in the case. According to published reports, some members of the IPA's board of directors disagreed with the decision to join the lawsuit, prompting the organization's president and CEO, Don Craven, to resign. Craven served as president and CEO since 2021 and as the organization's legal counsel for nearly four decades. IPA issued a news release Thursday announcing Craven's resignation and praising him for his service to the organization, but it did not mention what led to his departure. IPA board chairman Darrell Garth, president of the Chicago Citizen Newspaper Group, did not respond to a request from Capital News Illinois. The Illinois Press Association is not affiliated with the Illinois Press Foundation. Shifting to local news, Champaign County Court article, Urbana man charged with murder attempt. An Urbana man has been charged with attempted murder after he allegedly fired a gun six times at a vehicle last month. Demetrius Vaughn, 39, was also charged with unlawful possession of a weapon, aggravated battery, and three counts of discharging a weapon at an occupied vehicle. State's attorney Julia Reed said that around 1:15 p.m. on September 9, Urbana police responded to the intersection of Washington Street and Learman Avenue for a report of a fight with shots fired. The fight itself occurred at the Shell gas station near that intersection, and Reed pointed out in Vaughn's pretrial detention hearing Thursday that this was also in a residential area with an apartment building nearby. The dispatcher could hear yelling over the 911 call. On scene, officers found the named victim in the charges alongside his girlfriend and her daughter near their vehicle, which had gunshot damage, Reed said. The vehicle had been struck multiple times, and police would later find six bullet casings near the scene. The victim said that he was getting gas at the Shell station when Vaughn pulled up in a red 2020 Ford Explorer, Reed said. She said the victim openly admitted they were discussing previous drug dealings in which Vaughn claimed the victim owed him $700. Vaughn punched the victim first, and the fight escalated, according to the victim and the two witnesses, his girlfriend and her child. The victim said Vaughn had him in a headlock, while according to his attorney, Vaughn said the victim had him in a headlock. Either way, both said that Vaughn bit the victim. Vaughn then allegedly said he was going to go get his gun and come back to shoot the victim and went back to the Explorer where an unknown other individual was waiting. The victim admitted that he then went and got a car jack out of his own vehicle and hit the windshield of the Explorer with it. Surveillance footage from the Shell station matched up with the victim's and witness's version of events, Reed said. Vaughn then drove off, Reed said, and the victim went about filling up his gas tank. The victim and two witnesses got back in their vehicle and pulled out of the lot, headed east on Washington. Vaughn pulled up to the intersection, headed north on Learman, still driving the Red Explorer, Reed said. Vaughn allegedly got out at the intersection and fired six times at the victim's vehicle. While police were investigating, Vaughn's girlfriend called a report that the Explorer, which was registered to her, had been stolen. When officers arrived at her house, the Explorer was sitting outside with windshield damage consistent with the victim's account of hitting it with a car jack. She later admitted that Vaughn had called and told her to report it stolen, Reed said. Security footage from the apartment building where the girlfriend lives also showed Vaughn and the unknown other person arriving in the Explorer, entering the apartment, and then leaving again with consistent timing for him to leave the gas station and return to the intersection, Reed said. Champaign County Judge Brett Olmstead ruled that Vaughn will be detained as he awaits the resolution of this case. Moving on to another local article entitled, A Memorial She Dig, Clark Park Sand Pit, renamed Katie's Play Place in honor of the late Catherine Parkhill. After Katie Parkhill died on August 5, her obituary encouraged community members to donate to the Champaign Parks Foundation, and Clark Park in particular, in lieu of flowers. And although it's only been about 2 months, the foundation has already received donations in Katie's memory that total more than $20,000, said Champaign Park District Executive Director Sarah Sandquist. The Park District Board voted Wednesday to direct these funds toward improving the sand play area at Clark Park, which will be renamed Katie's Play Place. We are very overjoyed by the love and support and generosity from our friends and family, said David Parkhill, husband of Katie. Plans for the sand play area include adding a bench, two diggers, an ADA-compliant sand table, and a box for truck storage, Sandquist wrote in a report to the board. These additions are expected to cost $12,000. Excess donations will go into a dedicated fund for Katie's Play Place, ensuring it remains a welcoming and well-maintained community space for years to come. A plaque will also be installed. When staff reviewed potential improvements within the park with the Parkhill family, the sand play area stood out as a well-loved area, Sandquist told the News Gazette. The location provides a natural fit for a memorial that invites playful activity and community togetherness. The Park District expects to complete the improvements later this fall. The sand play area is currently closed as part of a separate Clark Park renovation project. David said that Clark Park holds a special place in his family's hearts and has for a long time. His father grew up in the surrounding area, and so did Katie's mother. It is also where he and Katie raised their children, and he and other members of the Parkhill clan still live nearby. It is a park that my children played at, and my grandchildren will play at, and Katie really enjoyed that park, so it is something we are very enthusiastic about. We are deeply grateful for the outpouring of support from family, friends, and community members in honor of Catherine Parkhill, Sandquist said. Their generosity has made it possible to create a meaningful and lasting tribute at Clark Park, one that will bring joy to children and families for years to come. We'll finish up the first half of today's reading with the top of the morning article on page 2 of the front section. Mickey Meeker may have been a bartender for the last dozen or so years, but he's not about to act like he doesn't enjoy a classic beer and a shot of Jaeger when he goes out. I don't pretend to have a pinky in the air when I'm indulging, Meeker said, but I do occasionally make an old-fashioned at home while we're cooking dinner or something, and drink it and walk around acting like a supervillain. But if you order a drink from Meeker, ask about his latest innovations on the Long Island. His bartending experience started when his family took on Fuzzy's 610 Tap in Danville in 2013. They still run it as a family business today, which Meeker admits has its ups and downs, but mostly its ups. It's been over a decade since I've worked other jobs, and I feel pretty fortunate to say that I work for my mom, Meeker said. Fuzzy's just moved locations within the last few months, and Meeker says it's a great time to come and check out the new spot. They've already had live music in the new location and have plans to start scheduling other classic bar events like trivia. The overall attitude of the bar hasn't changed at all. We're pretty laid-back folks, and we know everybody's coming out to cut away from reality for a little bit, he said. Come have a few drinks and enjoy some company. We'll take a short break and return with the second half hour of the Friday, October 10, 2025 edition of the News Gazette.